and welcome to another episode of the Bukkari Sellers Podcast. I oftentimes have cool opportunities to have shows where we can actually learn something, and today is one of those days where we have an amazing individual who's doing work in the region of the country that I love the most. Of course, the South is God's country. But Noel Didla, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Bukkari. How are you?
I'm more blessed than I deserve. We start each one of our episodes by having our guests walk us through the arc of their careers, and yours is decently unique. Your career starts in India, and then you move to Jackson, Mississippi, to start a career in academia at Jackson State, teaching English, but also as an activist in the Deep South. Can you talk about the various stops in your career in both India and Jackson, and why did you choose to teach at an HBCU?
Wow, that's a lot of territory to cover. I'll try my best. So Noel Didla, she, her pronouns, originally from Guntur, which is on the southeastern part of India. And then, so that makes me a person of the global South, right? And I'm right now making home in the Deep South in Jackson, Mississippi. Jackson, Mississippi is what my son and I call home. We've been making Jackson, Mississippi home for the last 17 years. So I'm an immigrant. So my life started in Guntur. My dad was the first Dalit Bahujan Christian vice president of a majority university in India, and by virtue of him being a caste minority and him being first generation somebody to make it to that level, from being a custodian all the way to becoming the vice president of a university, and also my grandparents, my mom's parents, my grandfather was a labor union organizer. And my grandmother was an elementary school teacher who taught first grade all her life. My great-grandparents, that is my grandmother's, maternal grandmother's parents, were both working railway labor jobs where they were laying the railroad track through the south central part of India. So they were field laborers, and also, what in our language it was called the coolies, meaning people who worked in labor gangs, right? So that's my background, basically. And my grandfather, on my dad's father, right? He was a butler to American medical missionaries. So my father grew up in Christian institutions, so Lutheran Christian institution. So the contradiction is India was colonized. The contradiction is that Christianity allowed economic mobility of my people, the Dalit Bahujan people, to some degree, by giving us access for the very first time to educational institutions and healthcare. So that's kind of like the legacy that I come with. So my father and mother, my mom's a retired sociology professor. So my dad was, he raised us in a way, my brother and I, in a way that we had no choice but to think about being people-centered. And so when you were asking that question about organizing and activism, I guess, my father's and mother's home, right? And even my grandparents' homes, they were natural extensions of a home to being community where organizing happened, because we traditionally or typically didn't have access to special organizing spaces. You had to make use of what spaces you had, right? So that's where it happened. So to me, I guess that's kind of like what I learned, seeing my parents and grandparents be who they were, because number one, they did not have a choice, and also they chose to.
Yeah. I feel this synergy with you, because my parents also, they gave us a choice, but then we didn't have a choice,
right?
But I'm also fascinated by people who aren't from the Deep South, who make the Deep South home, and it doesn't get more Deep South than Mississippi. Talk about the experience of being an immigrant of color, navigating both very Black spaces like Mississippi, but also spaces where racism and white supremacy have shaped much of the conditions and you see in places like Mississippi.
Yeah, so I got this opportunity to come to Jackson State University to first visit and then be a visiting scholar slash professor, and then also be part of coordinating international policy work that was institution based, right? And building institutional partnerships between Indian institutions and HBCUs. And until then, I did not have an understanding of what HBCUs were, except the fact that my father, as a university administrator, traveled and he presented at Howard. So he had this relationship. So it was like very surface level understanding. So when we started like building that relationship between Jackson State and institutions back home, it opened my eyes to seeing institutions within that institutional hierarchy that exists in America, right? And when I came here, that's something I also and I became I was offered a position to teach at Jackson State. And at that point in my life, my father passed away, and so I felt very uprooted. And because my father was my physical, emotional home.
Yeah,
And
I get that.
so yeah, when he transitioned, I just felt a very strong urge in my body and spirit to just leave Guntur, my hometown. And so with $66 and with no promise of a job or nothing, that's all I had personally on me in that moment. That doesn't mean I didn't have economic privilege, right? I want to be clear about that contradiction and distinction too. And so I came, I said, I'm going, I have to go. Something is pushing me to go. And I entrusted my son to my mom's care, and I came here. And then at Jackson State, I was able to find. In a very surprising way, I was able to find safety and home
Yeah,
that I never felt before.
that's what HBCUs are. I will rally behind Jackson State for that. Let's talk about food insecurity in the Deep South for a moment. When people use the word food insecurity, let's start with basics. What do they mean?
So it looks very different for a lot of people. Food insecurity could be as simple as not having access to, food, which could be not having access to where you can shop for food, to not having access to healthy food, and not having access to the means of even being able to buy food. It's a whole lot of things, Bakari. It's a whole lot of things. And so when we talk about food insecurity, and I can't speak for the entire South, right? I can only speak to aspects of what I'm engaged in. What I've experienced in terms of what's out here is food insecurity is real in Mississippi. Depending upon what year, Mississippi ends up being the last or the last but one in terms of how people experience food insecurity, and we have to specifically focus on BIPOC people experiencing food insecurity also as a huge issue and a huge challenge, and an issue of dignity that has to be fundamentally addressed through the lens of race, class, and gender.
I mean, you said you can't speak for the entire South, but maybe you can answer this question. Why is food insecurity the highest in the Deep South?
Food in you know the answer to this, I'm
I do. I mean, I just have to ask the question. Everybody don't know the answer to it. I mean,
right.
the Confederacy was here. It was home. It's an overlap of white supremacy. You see the remnants of structural racism. You see the remnants of slavery in everything we do. So food insecurity is logically the next step. But I wanted somebody smarter than I to be able to tell the listeners
I wouldn't claim I'm smarter
that.
than you, but all I can say is what you said is exactly what it is, the way this nation state has been structured, and the way the policies have, but continued to, uphold the safety and security of certain people, and continue to oppress certain people and their realities. So, that continues to impact how people's hunger is. Never addressed the way it should be, right? And it's not just, and the way the systems continue to continue to not allow for resources to impact dignity and security of people. So food insecurity sits within that framing of not thinking about people's dignity at the core of, not thinking about people's rights at the core of how we imagine life in abundance for all, not for a few.
This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else. This episode is brought to you by UGG. Y'all know UGG is a brand that athletes wear all the time in the tunnel and on travel days. Well, I bet you think UGG season is only during the colder months of the year. Au contraire, you're wrong. You need to check out the latest spring drop from UGG. They have everything from sandals to clogs. I like the sandals. UGG has you covered for your next spring adventure. Shop the Golden Collection at UGG.com.
Let me ask a stupid question. States like South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi are net exporters of food as deeply agrarian states that produce lots of food. Mm-hmm. But so many of their residents still go hungry on a regular basis. What's the disconnect here? Why do we see the highest rates of food insecurity in places that produce the most food? Is it simply poverty? Is that the answer to the question?
You know, I've struggled with that because that's a question we always ask ourselves, and especially during the pandemic, you know, we were able to see how we could actually address that in a very different way, right? We were able to do things a different way because we were faced with almost a no choice situation. But again, it's reversing now. We were able to, you know, kind of feed people during the pandemic in a very interesting, in many interesting ways. We were able to address hunger within our own communities. I'm not saying the government addressed it in the way that it should. It did to some extent, I suppose, again, you know, within the framework of the inequities that exist in the system. But we were able to, which also showed that we could do things differently, but we are again choosing not to, right?
So what's the role of the federal government in answering this question? And then I'm going to ask the same question about the state government.
Sure. We could go down the list, actually.
Yeah. and then we can go to city and local government. So let's just go down the list. Let's see what happens.
Truly, truly. Yes. So I would say the federal government right now, you know, I was just looking at this email that came through before we got on this call. The White House is getting ready to host a conference on hunger and food insecurity in September, and they're doing listening sessions right now. Beyond food insecurity, Bakari, I would say we should think about this issue as an issue of food systems and how inequitable the issues around food systems are, who has access to being part of leading food systems work from production to procurement. There is that whole pipeline, right? So we have to look at that and then engage in a question, fundamental question is, how do we invest in individuals, how do we invest in institutions? How do we invest in infrastructure that is actually going to equitably and justly change the nature of how food systems are so that local economies, state economies, or the economy of a country is impacted, right? With the focus on transforming food systems. So I think that's the question we are giving to ourselves, and that's the question we are challenging the federal government, state level, and then, you know, county and city level. And then that's the investment we are making in our own people in Mississippi, the BIPOC people in Mississippi through the Mississippi Food Justice Collaborative, Mississippi Food Systems Fellows, and through the Mississippi Food Policy Council work we do. We are investing in ourselves as individuals. We are investing in our collaborative strength. We are investing in the culture of ethical leadership pipeline we are creating through the fellowship, because if we don't self-determine what our food systems and economies can look like. We got to imagine what we want and what we deserve, and then invest and also organize and advocate for, and then push policy in that regard. So that's kind of like the challenge we are sitting with. And of course, you know this, you know, resources are always the investment we can make in ourselves in terms of relationships and, you know, working on policy and all that. But in order to be able to do things in a way that we inform and transform systems, it means that we would need sustainable resources. And that's where philanthropy can come in, government at all levels can come in, and resources can also look like, you know, legislative support and, all other things, right? So cultural support.
So that's what we are at. Explain to me really quickly the Mississippi Food Policy Council. I mean, you mentioned it. I know that's your baby.
Yeah.
What is it? What do you do with them? How does it close the gap between community and institutions like the government? Mm-hmm. And then I see South Carolina has one too. How can people support the work of these food policy councils?
So, we lost one of the founders of the policy council a couple of months ago. Her name is Judy Ballou, and I want to say she's the one who brought me into this work a few years back. And Policy Council, is an advocacy space for the most part. Typically, policy councils are advocacy spaces, right? The way we have in the last year shifted the nature and the structure and the programmatic work of our policy council is, we decided that we want to understand what racial equity, economic justice, environmental justice, labor rights as human rights, ethical leadership, food sovereignty, and health of communities can look like in practice. So we are going through immersive capacity building for the policy council, for the fellows, and for the collaborative. Together, around 40 of us are going through learning sessions where we are trying to see what does economic justice look like in practice. That means we pay our people for the whole year ahead of time, that we invest in each other.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, things like that.
But you have to do that, right, with some type of financial literacy too, don't you?
Yes, yes. And that's the piece where we are working with people at Hope Policy Institute and Hope Credit Union to help us with the financial literacy piece. Because again, you know, we come from communities where understanding and analysis of finance as a way of being healthy, right, impacting our health and wellness is an important thing. So we also have counselors who are also on this journey, because when we discuss race, when we think about equity and all, you know, trauma comes up. So we want to be clear about how do we take care of ourselves while also building community and being able to move at the speed of trust and value alignment and moving at the speed of relationships, because we are all in this work for only a few years. All of us are from different places, and then being able to think of ourselves as stewards of food systems in this time where our alignment is with our ancestors and the children yet to be born, that kind of continuum of how we behave in this moment of responsibility that is given to us, that comes with being able to shape systems change within ourselves as individuals to infrastructure, being able to do that in a very responsible way, in a responsive way. So that comes with who we are surrounding ourselves as thought partners and accountability partners. So it's very relational. Our work is very relational in all these aspects of what we are doing. So from the way we invest in ourselves starts with who do we want to be in this long-term relationship? So how can we be in principle, struggle with one another, understanding conflict will come? How do we engage on conflict? To how do we build the infrastructure that we can be proud of? So who are the infrastructure partners we bring to the table? How do we hold funders, which is philanthropy people, to be in accountable relationships with us? So Kellogg is a primary partner for us. And so how do we engage with Kellogg as equal partners, not them there and we here, like above and, you know, not in an inequitable relationship. So figuring all these things out. And that's been the journey for the last 5-6 years almost.
This episode is brought to you by NetSuite by Oracle. The less your business spends, the more margin of money you have. I think that's pretty obvious for everyone, but actually doing it, that's easier said than done, because the cost of everything is going up these days. So do the smart thing. Switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth, so you can easily reduce costs and headaches. NetSuite specifically helps by reducing IT costs, since it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, and cutting the costs of maintaining multiple systems, since everything you need is on one suite. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. See for yourself how effective NetSuite can be and try it out today. And by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/ringer. That is netsuite.com/ringer. This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else. This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.
Yeah, I mean, that's a long journey. Last couple of questions for you before we let you out of here, because this is a lot and I hope people are really digesting it and using that Google to figure out how they can support their food policy councils in their respective states. But you also do other work organizing politically across the Deep South. Can you talk about that work? And where do you see signs of promise politically in the South? Sometimes we get decently depressed, but signs of promise for progressives and for the kind of work that you do.
Yeah, beautiful thing being in the South is to be able to connect at so many levels, right? And making the choice to be in right relationship to people and right relationship to places and be able to move in those spaces with love and accountability. I see a lot of that happening in the organizing spaces in communities, arts and culture, you know, food security and all of that. And when it comes to politics, yes. Jackson, Mississippi, definitely, right?
Shout out to Chokwe Lumumba, the mayor, that grace. Yeah, for
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. And then Birmingham.
Randall Woofen, yes. Friend of the show, for sure.
Yes. And, I think Montgomery is looking promising, I would say. And then I can definitely think of those three, and there are others who are like Shreveport is trying, New Orleans has been trying, and
Little Rock is trying.
Little Rock is trying. Yeah.
Charlotte is booming.
Charlotte is doing amazing.
How can people help out and help the work that you do now? How can we do that?
I would say, you know, wherever you are, you know, figure out who your community of partners are, and you know, I would say, you know, be in principal struggle with your people and commit to that long-term relationship work that'll allow you to move with care, and that'll allow you and also craft a vision and move towards, making that vision come true, and fight for resources because you deserve them. We all deserve the resources. This land is ours and the future should be ours. So we should be able to deserve them and demand them.
Well, you know, we appreciate you. You are a friend of the show. Jared Lotho speaks so highly of you, and I do as well. So thank you for joining the Bakari Sellers podcast, Noah.
Thank you.